This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and all this hour, we're focusing on the coronavirus pandemic, reopening plans, and the latest infection numbers, which have some people pushing back on our reopening plans. In a few minutes, Boston City Councilor Kenzie Bock will join us to explain why she wants BU and Northeastern to rethink their plans for on-campus learning in the fall. And later in the show, we'll take your coronavirus questions with two infectious disease doctors. But first, we want to get the latest from WBUR meteorologist David Epstein as Tropical Storm Isaias moves this afternoon over New England. Here's Governor Baker.
Statewide, we expect the Tuesday evening and Wednesday morning commutes to be impacted by both the wind and the rain. So if you're going out, you should take it very slow and allow plenty of extra time to get to wherever it is you're going.
David Epstein, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
So we just heard the governor talk there about the wind and the rain. Where is Isaias right now, and how is it impacting New England?
So the center of it is located northwest of New York City now. It's south of Albany, so somewhere in the Hudson Valley. It's moving towards the north at about 40 miles an hour, and we have individual kind of thunderstorm cells on the right side. That's the drier side and the windier side of the storm. Most of those to date have been moving from Connecticut up through western Massachusetts and then on into New Hampshire. We just had a tornado warning. We still actually have it up near the Claremont, New Hampshire area. There's another one around Hartford right now. Eventually, some of these storms will try to develop in eastern Massachusetts, but it may or may not materialize in the Boston area. I think it's not a very widespread event, but it's an event where there can be severe weather here this afternoon for the next couple of hours.
What about flooding? Is there a potential for flooding in western Mass?
In western Massachusetts, out towards the Berkshires, certainly. But the thing's moving so quickly, it's probably just street flooding, things like that. You know, the type of thing where it's raining so hard, you have to pull over for 15 minutes. Or a little longer out there. But the back edge of the rain is already moving through the Litchfield Hills in Connecticut. It will be up into Pittsfield in the next hour, and it's out of here. So this is not a big event, and not to discount what the governor said, but tomorrow morning there's not going to be any problems with the commute at all. This thing's gone.
Gotcha. So you mentioned the tornado watch, and you know, we saw earlier over the weekend there were some tornadoes that touched down here in New England, strong winds. Any connection to what we already saw to Isaias?
No, not at all. So the weekend event, completely separate. What we've got now going on is when these tropical systems, any tropical system, comes on shore, the friction with the land tends to create a little more instability and a little more spin in the atmosphere. And the right side tends to be where that's occurring. If you think about the storms moving north, the right side has a southerly wind. So the winds and the storm's forward motion are kind of acting together. Whereas on the other side, the opposite side, the storm's moving north, but the winds are coming. The storm's moving north, but the storm winds are coming from the north. So they're fighting each other. So on this eastern side, that's where we tend to have more severe weather cropping up. And indeed, that's what we've seen from Pennsylvania all the way through New Jersey, New York, into Connecticut, and now into New Hampshire.
So you said by tomorrow morning, we shouldn't be seeing any more of Isaias. But David, I got to ask, you know, it's the beginning of August, and it seems a bit early in the season for a hurricane or a tropical storm. Is it actually early?
It is a little bit early to get a tropical system up this far, but it's not that unusual to get it in the summer. You know, we actually, what's more unusual is the fact that we haven't had a hurricane here since 1991 when Bob came on shore down towards the Cape. So it's been a long time since a hurricane has actually reached New England, and we are way, way overdue. These types of things, this thing going through, getting sort of press and all that, is nothing compared to what we would experience if an actual hurricane, and it will happen, comes on shore in New England. All these trees, 30 years without any real hurricane.
Are you expecting one soon? This season?
Who knows?
Who knows? No, but I mean, do you expect it to be a busy season, I should say?
Impossible to tell. Yeah, the season should be busier than average just because the waters are warm, and we're in more of a La Nina, so we don't have the wind shear down across the Atlantic. So it tends to be an active season. We're reaching, you know, the I in the alphabet as these storms get named very early. So we've had a lot of named storms already. So I suspect it will continue to be active, and we don't reach the peak until around September 11th.
Got it. So we've got a long way to go here. David, finally, I mentioned this at the top, but this hour we're focusing on the coronavirus pandemic. And I'm just wondering how you think folks should be thinking differently about preparing for this particular hurricane season while also dealing with the pandemic.
Yeah, I think any hurricane season, you know, as we're in, as you said, we have a month to go before we even reach peak. And that's just peak. It doesn't mean something can't happen after that. I think you just want to think about what would happen if a storm occurred and you couldn't necessarily get out of the house for a day or two. Your power was out for 3 or 4 days. and have those contingency plans. And in a lot of ways, preparing for a hurricane is not unlike what we had to prepare for in March when we kind of all got shut down. We were in our homes. We had food for a couple of weeks. It's really sort of the same thing. Unfortunately, with the virus, it's much longer lasting. A hurricane would probably be, you know, much more quick hitting and then be out of here.
Got it. Well, thank you. WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Northeastern and Boston University, the two largest universities in the city, plan to bring back thousands of students on campus in the fall for on-campus instruction. But as coronavirus cases continue to spike in states around the country, those plans are worrying some city officials. City Councilor Kenzie Bock wrote a letter to both the universities today asking them to completely abandon their on-campus plans and go entirely online this fall. Councilor Bock joins us now. She represents Mission Hill, Fenway, Back Bay, Beacon Hill, and the West End. Councilor, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Jamie. Great to be here.
So I just, before we continue, should note that BU holds the broadcast license to WBUR. Councilor Bock, there are dozens of colleges and universities in Greater Boston. Why are you singling out BU and Northeastern? I'm thinking of Emerson College, which is also in the heart of the city. They plan to bring back at least some on-campus students as well.
Well, as you mentioned, Jamie, these are the two largest institutions we have, and they also have a really high percentage of out-of-state students. So both BU and Northeastern, 75% of their students are out of state. And really the reason that I sent that letter is because I think we're just at the sort of last moment before the point of no return on bringing students back into the city. And right now, to me, the paramount public health concern for Boston is that we have a tradition where we increase our city population by 10% at the end of this month. And these students are a big part of that. And I think that doing that with the indicators where they are in Massachusetts and really where the indicators are the rest of the country is just not wise. And we look to Northeastern and BU to really be leaders on this.
I see. So you mentioned the point of perhaps no return. We're only a few weeks away from students actually getting here. So are we too close to that point of no return for these two universities to completely change their plans and go all virtual?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say it would be completely changing their plans. I think one of the things is that both these universities, and I think really all our universities, have made plans for mixed instruction where you've got at least some virtual option for students who are choosing to stay home or who have to stay home. And so what's good about that is they're already set up to do virtual teaching. And so it's just a question of closing down the option of doing the in-person instruction. And I don't think it's too late. I think there are a lot of students who, because everything has been so up in the air, haven't signed leases. And I just think that when we're talking about the public health of the city and our wider community and, you know, the off-campus neighborhoods that I represent, we can't sleepwalk our way into anything, right? It can't be too late to make the necessary public health interventions.
So would a complete shift to virtual learning be enough in your opinion? I'm thinking, you know, other things that the city would need to do, addressing the return of people to their offices or international travel through Logan Airport, beyond just addressing the universities.
Well, the city and the state, right, we're having to think about like harm mitigation and reduction in every sense in every industry all the time right now. And of course, there's going to be a million steps we have to take. And some students are going to be at our universities and we're going to have to be thinking that through regardless. I think to me, it's the point here is really that the biggest harm reduction step we could take for the city right now is to bring fewer people into our ecosystem from all over the country where we're seeing these coronavirus hotspots. That's sort of step one upstream, right? And then yes, absolutely, there'll be lots of things that we have to do downstream, however it shakes out.
So Councilor, WBUR reached out to BU and Northeastern and they responded to your letter. BU says in part it will, quote, continue to work with the councilor and her constituents to prioritize their health and safety, along with the health and safety of the entire BU community. And Northeastern says in part, quote, we are moving cautiously and carefully ahead with the plans we announced in June. So what's your reaction to that?
I just hope that they continue to reconsider the situation as we're getting, you know, new data day by day. I'm very sympathetic to the fact that the universities have put a ton of effort into these plans, and they're very elaborate and there's lots about them to admire. And I think the testing capacity that they've stood up is substantial. But I think what I'm tasked with is looking at, you know, the neighborhoods I represent where you've got a bunch of vulnerable elders living in place. You've got a lot of essential workers. And then the question becomes, is this enough for it to be worth the risk of bringing all these students back in this large wave? And I think the answer is just no. So to me, it's not to say that they haven't put a ton of thought and energy into these plans. I think it's just that when you zoom out at a sort of macro public health level, it doesn't make sense.
So, and we'll be talking the rest of the hour about the coronavirus pandemic, but I'm struck by this idea that you also represent students and parents. And so I'm curious what you're hearing from them about the other side of this coin, another missed term on campus or the type of learning that happens online, which is not the same as on-campus learning. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we all know this is a terrible situation. I actually teach undergraduates. Like, I think that learning in the classroom is amazing. And we all know everyone like wants to be in those communities. I think it's just that I think what I hear actually from a lot of parents and students is a sort of half recognition, sometimes full recognition already, that there's a good chance that even if we started this way, we might be in a place in a month where we have to shut it back down again, right? And I think everybody knows that we all wish we were living in a post-vaccine or pre-COVID world, but we have to kind of square up to the situation we are in. And actually, I've heard from a lot of students and their parents who are also concerned and wish this weren't the case, but see the merits of virtual learning for the time being. And to me, there's no way out but through here, right? We've got to bring transmission down. We've got to contain this virus aggressively, contact trace. And maybe that puts us in a position to be talking about in-person instruction in the spring, right? But there's no way around the tough spot that we're in right now. And we've got to be mitigating risk however we can, and switching to virtual learning is part of that.
Well, and part of that struggle too is the struggle of small businesses. You know, I'm thinking of all of those local places that rely on the foot traffic from students, the laundromats, the whatevers, the sub shops, right? And so what are you hearing from them about fears of yet another extended, if these students don't come back, another extended period with fewer customers?
Yeah, I think it's terrifying, and everyone feels that, but that's the situation that we're in. I mean, you're going to be spending the hour talking about it, right? But the reality is that we have not succeeded as a society yet in knocking this thing down to a scale where we can really robustly reopen. And that's so frustrating. It's infuriating to me as someone at the local level.
So then what can the city council do to mitigate that business loss?
I think we can continue to do the things the city's been doing around the edges, right? Which is, we did small business grants and loans from the city, helping people with reopening safely. How do you adjust to takeout? How do you have, you know, spots in front of your establishment? And then all of us need to be advocating in a big way at the federal level for more support for our small businesses and our universities, right? I mean, there's absolutely a ton of jobs on the line here, and we need to be supporting them economically. And it's just we're in the middle of a disaster, right? Of a pandemic emergency, and part of what government has to do in that situation is step in and backstop people financially.
Well, so I want to ask you about what government can do as well. I'm thinking in terms of the teeth that the city council has to actually impact how universities choose to bring their students back. Can the council really stop BU or Northeastern or any other college from moving forward on any of their plans?
I think when it comes to an order, that has to come at the governor's level. I think that we can advocate and use our voices. That's what I'm doing today. Speak up for the, you know, neighbors living in our off-campus communities, where things that are usually quality of life issues, students having parties, are turning into life and death issues. But I certainly don't have the power to compel the universities, but I do think that we have the power collectively as a community in Boston to talk through how we keep everybody safe.
And Councillor, before I let you go in our final moments here, I do want to ask you about Boston Public Schools potentially reopening. Maybe you saw today that the UN Secretary General called on countries around the world to prioritize reopening in-person schooling as he fears a, quote, generational catastrophe from the pandemic. We know Boston will either be all remote or hybrid remote in-person in some fashion. Which way do you think the city should take?
I think the superintendent has just released a plan, and I haven't had the chance to read it yet. I think just in the last like hour or so. So I'm going to go look at where BPS has landed tentatively so far before I comment on that further. I think that, it's the same kind of, you know, terrible set of of conflicting situations here. And one thing I would say is I think everybody recognizes that our kids need so much support to get through this year ahead, regardless of whether it's virtual or hybrid. I mean, our schools provide so much support when they're in person day to day. And we're just going to need a kind of moonshot of civic resources to help support them through this moment of learning loss, whichever way the schooling plan shakes out.
Got it. Well, that's Boston City Councilor Kenzie Bock. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
So listening into that conversation was WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I want to ask you, because we just heard Councillor Bock there say that there's a potential school plan being released right now for the city of Boston. Do you have that yet?
I do not have that yet. It is something that we are watching closely. I know the school committee meeting is coming up on Wednesday, so tomorrow. So we are reaching out and looking into a few things, but don't have that information just yet on the K-12 system.
Okay, we're going to continue following that. The WBUR newsroom will continue following that as it becomes available. Carrie, I want to ask you then what your other reactions were to what we just heard from Councillor Bock.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she makes a good point. I mean, between BU and Northeastern, that they bring in a lot of students to the area. I mean, just looking at their student body numbers, it's about 61,000 students. That's undergraduates and graduate students, which is about half of all of the enrolled college students in the, you know, Boston area. So, you know, by making action on just these two schools, it does make a big impact. So, you know, I think whatever these two schools do, you know, that, like I said, that is going to make a big impact. And then she also brings up a really interesting point here, too, politically, is that city council's kind of in a tough spot here. You know, colleges are governed on the state level. So there are some things that city council can do, whether it's loans or making city policies about gatherings and things like that. But yeah, it will be interesting to see as the next school year starts just how the city might be able to get involved and how they do get involved to keep this under control.
So put BU and Northeastern in the context for us, because they're just, as we mentioned, two of the many schools in the greater Boston area. How are the other schools around here dealing with this exact question?
Well, I mean, some have changed course, actually, just in the last few weeks, even. Berklee College of Music is the most recent to change their plans. I know Simmons University has announced that they are going to be all virtual this fall. And then you've got a few who are attempting to do something in between, sort of like Harvard. They're allowing about 40% of their student body on campus, but instruction is going to be online. You know, so it kind of is a range here in Boston, or in the Boston area, rather.
So I know we are so far from what we could describe as from a usual year, right? We're far from normal here. But what's the normal impact on the city of Boston of all of these students coming in economically, numbers-wise?
Yeah, so the Boston Planning and Development Agency did a report in 2017, and they say that there's about 138,000 undergrad and grad students who are enrolled in the greater Boston, like colleges and universities. You know, and those students do gravitate towards a variety of housing. Only about 43% of those students live within city limits, though. And breaking that down, about 44,000 of those students, of that 43%, opt to live off campus. So that's a lot of rental space. That's a lot of housing that's not inside campus control, you know, that could be taken up this fall.
And so could have economic ripple effects as well. In that sense,
depending on what students choose, whether to come back or whether they opt for online only.
So I hear Councillor Bock in her strenuous plea to put public health and public safety first. But there are other factors on the other side of this coin. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that you guys have mentioned already was just like the financial strain on the businesses in and around the colleges, the things that are amid like foot traffic, you know, sandwich shops, et cetera. But, you know, when you look at the colleges themselves, this pandemic has been a really big financial strain on them. You know, like when students had to vacate last year, a lot of schools issued partial refunds for room and board. That was hugely expensive. And then, you know, just to put that into context, especially if a college is opting to go all remote next year, like they're not doing in-person at all, I mean, room and board is a really significant revenue generator at a lot of colleges. I looked at Northeastern's numbers just for an example, and it can cost a student about $11,000 to $15,000 per year for room and board. And that's about a third of the total cost of attending the school. You know, and then you look at the other numbers of just how many people do live on campus each year. That's about 75% of their undergraduates, at least. So, you know, looking at how much that could cost, those numbers could be significant.
So we heard a little bit from both universities in our conversation with Counselor Bach. Do you have any more information about what they're saying about right now, their plans for the fall?
The university's plans from the fall, I mean, most of the communication we're getting, you know, especially with BU, I know being licensed by BU, we do get a lot of their notifications. I know they are working really hard on, you know, testing and getting those policies and procedures in place as to where students should go and how long the turnaround time is and that kind of thing. So I think there's still a lot of procedure that's being worked out from what I can tell. But so far, especially with these two big schools, they are moving forward with in person, but also giving people that option to stay remote if they want to.
So, in giving people that option to stay remote, what are you hearing from students? Are they taking up the schools on that offer?
Well, students' response has really been really, really mixed. I spoke with one student this afternoon, Miranda Rodea. She's from Texas. And she's going into her fourth year at Northeastern. And she said she decided really recently, like 2 weeks ago, that she was going to stay home. First, she said, if campus life is just going to be really altered and so many rules were going to be there and, you know, like gatherings wouldn't be allowed in the first place, she said it's not going to be the same. And she'd save a lot of money in housing costs. Plus, she said she was really impacted by seeing the COVID numbers really explode in Texas over the summer. And she said she didn't want to see that same thing happen again in Boston with everyone coming back. Let's hear what she had to say.
I just don't trust the student population as a whole to be responsible. And I just had a bad feeling about going back and thought, you know, I'm just going to experience the same thing that I experienced here at home.
But there are other students that say, you know, we can trust our peers. You know, like if your suite mate comes down with COVID or tests positive, then that means you are also quarantined. So like you can kind of hold each other accountable. A student from BU, a rising junior, her name was Tanya Grover. She said that she is planning to come back, but she said that decision really had more to do with her productivity experience in online classes from last spring. Let's hear what she had to say.
It was so hard to do school at home just because I was so used to being in my own like independent like room and having to like plan my own schedule. But I just feel like the level of focus that I had at home was extremely hard to like be able to do my class as well.
And, you know, from what the Edify desk has been reporting and has been hearing, there are a lot of mixed feelings among professors and other college staff too. So really, it really just depends, I guess, is how that ends up.
A lot of uncertainty there. Carrie, just in our last 30 seconds here, what are you watching for going forward in the next couple of weeks before these schools return?
You know, I mean, I'm looking for, you know, updates in testing policies and procedures. Like I said, there's a lot of logistics being planned out right now. And then I think there could be a possibility, whether or not it's, you know, these big schools that decide, nope, we're going to change course. But I think there might be space for other schools to change course and sort of pull back on more of their in-person learning.
That's WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Most of Massachusetts has been in phase 3 of its reopening since July 6th, so about a month now. Boston was a little delayed, and Somerville has held out, continuing to delay their Phase 3 plans. But for most of the state, Phase 3 means folks can, with restrictions, enjoy a meal indoors, get back to the gym, and go to entertainment venues like movie theaters and the casino. For the last week or so, there have been some signs of an uptick in cases, and some epidemiologists are calling for the state to roll back its reopening. During his coronavirus press briefing today, Governor Baker says the state is closely monitoring the data and will adjust plans if needed.
We're not taking any options off the table when it comes to fighting COVID, reopening the Commonwealth, getting back to a new normal, It all depends in many respects on everybody playing their part and doing their job. We've only had a slight uptick from a low of 1.7% to 2%, but we'll be forced to adjust our plans if the data warrants it.
So for the rest of the hour, we're going to take your coronavirus questions for our regular Ask the Doctor segment. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with any of your coronavirus-related reopening questions. But for more context on this pushback against the state's reopening plans, we're joined now by WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Jamie.
So we just heard the governor, but give us some more of those fresh numbers.
Okay, here are the freshest numbers. They're actually looking a bit better the last day or two. You know, they usually come out around 4 p.m., so we'll see in a few minutes what the very latest ones are. But yesterday's were looking not bad. We had 165 new confirmed cases. So for that day, that was just 1.3% of the tests are positive. And then you heard Governor Baker say that when he said that we were at 2%, that's a rolling 7-day average of tests, 2% are positive.
So then what's the concern there among those who are pushing for Massachusetts to maybe take a step back in its reopening?
Well, of course, the central concern is no one wants to go back to what we had this spring, right? And starting in late July and through last weekend, we were seeing some numbers that were headed in the wrong direction. You know, nothing huge, but at one point, the percentage of tests that were positive did go above 2% for a couple of days. And there were also a couple of days where we had more than 300 confirmed and probable new cases, whereas we'd sort of gotten used to seeing less than 300. So, you know, it seemed to be enough of an uptick that experts started saying, as he said, you know, it might make sense to roll back the reopening a bit to an earlier phase, especially if we want to maximize our chances to reopen schools, at least partly in person next month. Here is Dr. Ashish Jha from Harvard.
If we said, okay, forget schools, we don't really care if kids are all online, then you probably have a bit more running room. You can let the infections rate get higher. You won't fill up your hospitals too much. And, you know, people will get sick and some people will die, but you can tolerate a certain level. If you actually care about schools, then you probably need to tolerate a much, much lower level of indoor gatherings. And that includes restaurants, bars, gyms.
Okay, but Carrie, Governor Baker has been arguing that any sort of uptick that we've been seeing the last week in the numbers is a result of individual bad behavior and not the reopening plans writ large. Is there evidence to support that idea?
Well, yes. I mean, we've seen multiple accounts of recent parties that turned into sort of super spreader events. And as Ashish Jha says, the data seems very clear that it's indoor gatherings that pose the greatest risk for any kind of significant spread or transmission of the virus. That seems to drive a lot of the transmission. But I would add, it's also interesting that Governor Baker said today that there's been a lot more free testing in communities where there have been lots of positive tests. So that does add more cases that might not have turned up otherwise. Now, he's not saying like President Trump, well, you know, it's a problem we have more testing because then we have more cases. He's saying more testing is a good thing, but still it does add to the count.
What about other efforts in play here? I'm thinking of contact tracing, which we've covered on this show and has had a number of flaws going on, but also the governor's new travel restrictions, which went into effect on Saturday. How effective are those if we're still seeing at least a modest uptick in this reopening?
Right. Well, we can't say about the travel restrictions because they only took effect, as you said, on Saturday. But Governor Baker says thousands and thousands of people have filled out those online forms already. We don't have any word yet on whether anyone has actually been penalized, but at least it sounds like there's, you know, copious participation. Contact tracing, as you say, it has issues, but it does seem to help. It's just hard when you have a virus that so often spreads or apparently seems to spread from people who are asymptomatic and may never get symptoms. So contact tracing does have limitations just naturally.
So how is this framing the response in the state, especially as discussions continuing about reopening other parts of society? I mean, if we roll back reopening businesses or don't, what does that mean for the prospects of reopening schools in the fall?
Well, this is where we seem to be starting to see sort of a clash in priorities. Like we have academics like Ashish Jha saying, you know, which does our society care about more, dining indoors and going to the gym or getting our kids back in school in the fall? Of course, it's a lot more complex than that. But if the numbers do head further in the wrong direction, that sense of a trade-off or a clash could become more acute.
Okay, so I asked Carrie Young this. I'll ask you as well. What are you looking for in the next couple of weeks as we creep toward the September 1st students coming back future?
Right. So what I'm watching for is whether the state announces any formal threshold for when there would be a rollback or when schools could not open even partially. We haven't gotten any official word on that. Governor Baker was asked repeatedly today, and he doesn't want to set a clear number. But what we're seeing in New York is, for example, Governor Cuomo says schools can only open if the rolling average of the percentage of positive tests is under 5%. And New York City just said that the percentage positive rate has to be below 3% because the city is so dense. So Jamie, that's the number that I look for every day, is what's our percentage positive rate?
Got it. All right. Well, we're obviously going to continue talking about this. Carrie Goldberg is WBUR's Common Health Editor. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And the calls are lining up here and standing by to take your calls and questions on the coronavirus pandemic is Dr. Shira Durone. She's an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Durone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line is Dr. Joshua Barocas, infectious disease. This is a mouthful. Infectious diseases physician and assistant professor of medicine at Boston Medical Center and the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Barocas, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I do want to start there right before we get to some calls here about what we just heard from Carrie Goldberg, COVID-19 cases, maybe a slow creep upward in the Commonwealth. Do each of you think we're doing okay in our reopening, or should we scale it back? I'll start with you, Dr. Durone.
Well, we're doing okay. We don't like a slow creep. It's better than a spike. And I think what we're really missing is, in terms of knowledge here, to be able to answer your question, is what is the cause of the slow creep? Is it infections that are being acquired in businesses that were recently reopened, like gyms, casinos, and indoor restaurants, or is it, as Governor Baker has suggested, due to super spreader events, gatherings where people are not following guidelines in terms of size and face coverings and distancing. And that the answer to that question really impacts what we need to do next.
Dr. Barocas?
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Durone, and I would just add, you know, I would say that we are doing okay, but I would rather honestly be a little early to the party, the metaphorical party,
the closing actual party,
one.
You mean?
Yes, than a little bit late. And so while we're figuring all of this out and we're watching this sort of slow creep and this baseline number of cases that we keep seeing and baseline positivity rate, personally, I'd like to be a little bit sooner to the party.
So, Dr. Durone, Dr. Barocas, our lines are full here, so I'm going to go to the phones. Sharon is calling from Newton. Sharon, what's your question for the doctors?
Hi. I'd like the epidemiologist to let us know what they think about having a ceiling fan on in your home when French doors, sliders, and windows are open with screens to the best extent possible when you're entertaining people who are not within your immediate COVID bubble.
So expanding your bubble, are you wearing masks?
Sometimes, sometimes not. Say if you're serving a meal and you're at least 8 feet apart.
Got it. Thanks, Sharon. All right. How about that, Dr. Durone, Dr. Barocas?
Well, doors open are better than doors closed, and a ceiling fan that creates good airflow and good ventilation is good because it's stagnant air, close quarters is bad. Now, the thing about fans, window unit air conditioners, is there have been cases where the directional flow of that air is just perfect to increase your risk of COVID. But I think that in general, if all the windows and doors are open and the air is coming from the top, it's probably better than not having it at all.
And Dr. Barocas, what about this idea of expanding your bubble and having, you know, maybe combining two bubbles or having other folks over who you haven't seen in a long time, but who have generally, as far as you could tell, been following the rules?
Right. So I'm sympathetic to the fact that we have all been more or less locked away in our homes and separated from the rest of our social social networks for the last 5 months or so. And the issue of bubbles and pods is a very difficult one, especially as we start to talk about school reopenings. I think that the safest way to do any of that is to ensure that you've had a period, hopefully somewhere along the lines of 7 to 14 days, more on the I'm more comfortable with the longer end, about 14 days of quarantine before you plan to expand your bubble, so that both parties, both people or groups of people, have not actually been in contact with anyone else. It would have let the duration of the illness, if you were asymptomatic, sort of run its course, and in that case, you would probably be a lot safer. The one thing I'll say is it is still very nice outside, maybe even a little too hot. But in all circumstances, if you are going to expand your bubble, it's still safer to have those outdoor gatherings as opposed to indoor gatherings.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Call us with your coronavirus questions. We have Jim calling us from Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim, what's your question for the doctors?
Good afternoon. Masks are obviously a big part of this, but then again, there's all kinds of masks, everything from surgical N95s to Korean N95s to homemade masks and on and on and on. Is it for the normal course of a person's life a notion that any mask is better than no mask, or does one hedge one's bet in a worthwhile way by getting the surgical masks, and that and probably other aspects of that you guys can think of question.
Yep, we got it there, Jim. Thanks for calling. How about that? Is there different efficacy between different types of masks, and how should folks be thinking about them?
Well, there is different efficacy, but you're right that any mask is better than no mask. And I'm still a believer that the surgical or medical grade masks should be saved for the healthcare setting, because we're still expecting a lot of cases in hospitals and clinics, and there's still a constrained supply chain. So I generally do advise cloth face covering, and there is a difference between, you know, a single ply thin bit of fabric versus what I usually say is three layers of fabric are better.
And I don't I corroborate that story of Dr. Drone, and I think that especially in this time where somehow masks have become a highly controversial topic, I'm all for the fact that some barrier is better than no barrier whatsoever. And there's actually been some debate on, and I know that there's some strong beliefs out there about the masks with the one-way valves. Again, if you're going to wear a mask, I'm happy with that. And I would rather you wear something than not wear something.
We have Jan, who's calling from Sandwich. She has a question about testing. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I haven't heard anywhere in any of the news shows if there's data on when somebody tests positive, at what point and when are they going to be negative. Very curious about that.
So you mean if you tested once, you're positive, and then tested again 2 weeks later, you want to know?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, can people be positive for months? Can they be positive for a week, a year? I mean, is there any sort of data follow-up on people who are positive, and at what point do they become negative? Like, when does the virus leave someone's body, especially if they're not symptomatic?
Got it.
I don't know if it leaves it quicker.
That's a really important question. Because one of the things I've been getting concerned about when I look at the Massachusetts data is how many of the positive tests are actually repeats in patients who are already known to be positive. And with our testing constraints, we should not be doing all of those repeat tests, because the answer is that people stay positive for a really long time, weeks, months sometimes, and it doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't mean anything in terms of being able to pass it on or symptoms?
Correct, in terms of being able to pass it on. We know that from lots of other infections that we diagnose using PCR-based tests, that the PCRs can stay positive. They represent dead organism. They represent organisms that are trapped in your cells, and that cells, those cells need time to kind of slough and regenerate, but it doesn't represent that you're still infected or contagious. Now, you may still have symptoms for a long time, too. There's an immune-mediated component to this disease, so symptoms can last a long time, too. But there's a lot of data out there that, now that shows that almost everybody will become no longer contagious by day 9. Very, very sick patients, people with severe immune compromising conditions could have potentially live virus in their bodies out to maybe day 20, but that's pretty rare, and we still don't even know if that's contagious. Almost everybody is going to be no longer contagious, and the CDC says can be released from isolation by day 10 after their symptom onset.
So that's why that sort of two-week period that folks have been following is a good rule of thumb.
Well, that's a different thing, right? So the 14 days is about the incubation period of the virus. That's from the time you're exposed to the time you develop symptoms. And so that's why when you come back from travel, for example, it's a 14-day quarantine. This is different. This is the 10 days of isolation for someone who has the disease.
Got
two different numbers. Unrelated.
So many things to keep track of here.
Yeah.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. We have Patty calling from Marston Mills. Patty, what's your question for the doctors?
Yes, I heard you say earlier Governor Baker had said that he thinks the slow uptick is from the parties, possibly bars or maybe eating indoors. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I'll have 18 kids in my class not required to wear masks, eating two meals a day in my room, or I'll be with them for 6.5 hours. How is that different from a party?
Thank you, Patty. It's a good question. Give that to you, Dr. Brokus.
Yeah, Patty, that's an excellent question. I know that this is something that teachers and schools and school districts are struggling with across the country right now. What we know thus far is honestly that masks work. Even if, and it reduces your probability, your likelihood of infection, just because there's virus around you doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to A, pick up that virus, and B, that you're going to become infected with that virus. So anything that we can do to reduce that probability is going to help you and is going to help anyone who's in a school. So for instance, in your class of 18 kindergartners, you're going to likely spread those children out. And so if someone is infected or symptomatic, hopefully there's a distance between that child and someone else. At the same time, for you individually, the likelihood that that child who's sitting somewhere in the class is going to transmit to you, if you're wearing a mask, generally at all times, practicing good hand hygiene and distancing as much as possible, the likelihood that that is going, that we're going to go through every layer of that's necessary to get infected is probably fairly low. Hopefully school districts are contemplating, I know that they are, screening, symptom screening, and other types of protective measures for teachers and for students. It is a little different than bars and restaurants, mostly because in a lot of these bars, there aren't facial coverings required. There isn't a lot of social distancing happening. And of course,
And I should note that under phase three, strictly bars are not open yet. Restaurant
absolutely.
Bars aren't. But
yes.
I want to see if we could squeeze in maybe one more question here. We have Rachel calling from Everett.
Hi, I'm wondering, from my understanding, COVID is a illness that can be contracted more than once. And I'm trying to understand what the data has been showing about people who've had COVID once. Have they gotten it again? How soon after?
Thanks, Rachel. How about that, Dr. Derone?
So we think that COVID is probably an illness that will be able to be contracted more than once based on what we know about other coronaviruses. But we have not yet definitively found a person who's contracted COVID-19 more than once. Now, the CDC is has very carefully crafted some of its recent guidance so that we don't miss those people if they were to pop up. And so they've said that people should not be retested within the first 90 days after their initial infection, but that if somebody were to get better from COVID and then become sick again after 90 days, there should be a consideration to test them and isolate them again and do contact tracing. But that's not because it's been seen. It's because we don't want to miss it.
And very, very quickly, we have a caller who I don't think we're going to get to who is asking about virus entering your body through your eyes. Is that something folks should be concerned about?
So there is, there can be conjunctival transmission. So if I sneeze into someone's eye, that's why a lot of healthcare workers, when they're in the hospital setting or in the ambulatory setting, are wearing goggles or face shields. I do know that some schools are considering those as well. It's still low likelihood. And again, if both parties out on the street are wearing a mask and distancing, the likelihood of that that being the mode of transmission is fairly low.
Got it. And, you know, I just want to ask finally in our last few moments here, I know that there's so much doom and gloom with this virus, and I don't want to forget the 155,000 Americans who have died during this pandemic so far. I also am just wondering from each of you all, so I'll start with you, Dr. Derone, where you draw your hope during this pandemic?
Little things. It's the, you know, it's the package I got in the mail yesterday from a mom from my kid's school with a mask in it just to say thank you. You know, it's the little thank yous. It's the little, you know, glimmers of kindness that keep me going.
That's sweet. Dr. Brokus, just 30 seconds here.
Yeah, I'm still encouraged by the fact that by and large, we have almost every single person in not just the U.S., but across the globe working on this one issue. Everyone's attention, and I can't remember a time when by and large the vast majority of the globe was focused on improving something for everyone.
Yeah. That's Dr. Joshua Brokus. He's an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Brokus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Shira Derone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Derone, thanks to you.
Thank you.